I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, our conversation today about what cities are doing to make themselves kid-friendly to try to stop what's being called family flight. But first, President Bush made a flight and a surprise Labor Day visit to Iraq today. The president, who last visited Iraq in June 2006 and also spent Thanksgiving there in 2003, was supposed to leave Washington today for an economic summit in Australia, but instead, Air Force One left secretly last night, flying to an air base in a remote part of Anbar province, northwest of Baghdad. Today, President Bush was reportedly told by a Marine pilot that U.S. troops don't have enough training or time at home, but when the president asked him the morale of the troops, the Marine said it was very high. Well, for more, we turn to Newsweek correspondent Larry Kaplow. Larry, first of all, what's being said about the timing of this visit and why the president chose to go to Anbar province?
Well, so far the people here at the embassy haven't been saying anything about the intentions of this, but it looks clearly like it's a way of building momentum and previewing some of the points that will be made next week when General Petraeus and Ryan Crocker, the U.S. ambassador here, speak to Congress. He's gone to Anbar province, which they've said repeatedly is one of the signs of localized successes that they'll be pointing to try to convince Americans that there's a purpose to staying on with the war here in Iraq.
Anbar province, to remind ourselves, was a hotbed of fighting against U.S. forces, and then this largely Sunni province has most recently been fighting the small al-Qaeda in Iraq forces that are in that area, and U.S. officials seeing that as a good sign. David Sanger wrote in the New York Times yesterday that President Bush just approved a new economic assistance plan for Anbar province, and on Friday reportedly talked about ways to pressure Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki to give millions of dollars to the reconstruction of the Sunni area. Maliki, of course, a Shiite. Is the Bush administration perhaps circumventing Maliki by making this trip, you know, in other words, achieving some of those elusive political benchmarks without the politicians?
That's exactly right. They are trying to show Maliki that he can help them or not, but even if he doesn't, they're going to try to build these separate relationships with people who he ultimately views as possible political rivals down the road. They have taken him out to Anbar. He has said that he's willing to support the tribes out there, but the tribal leaders out there have complained that the government is not giving them the support they need. The Americans worry that if they don't ultimately get the support they want from the government, just as they switch sides from al-Qaeda and join the U.S., the tribes could switch sides again, become disillusioned, and start fighting the U.S. again.
Right. Is there a sense on the ground that time is running out for Maliki?
There's certainly growing frustration. There's more voice to that frustration. You hear it from American officials, and not here so much, but in Washington, Maliki's government is aware of this pressure. The question is, before the U.S. can start contemplating regime change again in Iraq, is who they would replace Maliki with. And on that, there seems to be quite a lot of division and not a lot of strong candidates.
There have been leaks of General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker's upcoming report, but we understand that the president received a preview on Friday. Is there any sense that his visit might be an attempt to offset what the report is going to say or to, to underline it?
Well, I think it's to try to put a point on the parts they want to highlight, which is Anbar province. They try to steer people away now from looking at the central government too much because the central government of Nouri al-Maliki has not come through on the demands the U.S. has been placing on them. Now, there's some signs that they could try to make another run at that this week when the Iraqi parliament comes back. But clearly, they want to get attention focused on what they call localized success, places like Anbar and a few other places where they think that they're making progress even though the central government is stalled and dysfunctional.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Larry, you're there in Baghdad. I mean, what does the city feel like, again, with this report around the corner? Are everyday Iraqis waiting for this report? Do they not pay any attention? Are they more concerned about their electricity? I mean, sort of what's the scene like where you are?
You're right. They're more concerned about things like security and, second of all, electricity. Iraqis have grown very skeptical of anything that's touted as progress or a milestone. They're not going to focus on the report. They've seen these things come and go, these important dates from election to constitutional drafting. They just want to see results on their street.
Mm. And before we let you go, we were reading reports recently about some of the problems for Iraqis who want to leave, Iraqis who may want to take advantage of some of the moves in the U.S. to bring more Iraqi refugees here. And we understand that they can't even apply for it unless they leave the country, which might be a dangerous trip for them. Do you get a sense that Iraqis are still steadily leaving, or the ones who are there, are they staying?
Oh, many of the ones who are here still want to leave. We have a story in the magazine today about how Sunnis in western Baghdad, which have traditionally been their neighborhood, are fleeing because the Shiite militias over several months have been taking them over block by block, house by house, in a very systematic way. They're looking for other places they can go, whether it's outside of Baghdad or outside of the country. It's very difficult for an adult male to even cross the border into Jordan now. More are looking to try to go to Syria, but once they get to Syria, they don't get jobs. It's very difficult to put their families into social welfare programs or their children into school. So the avenues are being closed off, but many people still want to leave the country.
Larry Kaplow, reporter for Newsweek magazine, speaking to us from Baghdad as President Bush visits the Anbar province in Iraq today. Larry, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, we want to spend a few minutes today looking at American cities because apparently some of them could use a modern-day Pied Piper to lead children back in. The Boston Globe reports that several large cities, including New York, Chicago, Seattle, and here in Boston where we are experiencing what's called family flight. Couples who were drawn to cities in their 20s now heading for the suburbs because they have children. While California cities like Santa Ana, Fresno, and Bakersfield have the largest kid populations in the country, all over 30%. San Francisco, Seattle, and Boston are at the bottom, and they're going through a child shortage with the underpopulation hitting 14 to 20%. So what happens to a city when kids leave? We want to find out about that and hear how cities like San Francisco are trying to get kids and their middle-class families back. Michael Blanding wrote about all of this in yesterday's Boston Globe magazine. His article is entitled The Departing. It's a play on words of the film The Departed, which was made here in Boston. Michael, welcome.
Thanks.
I want to address right off the bat something that many listeners may be thinking is the answer to the question, why are, you know, middle-class families with kids leaving cities? And it's because of, you know, older stories of mass retreats from the city. So right off the top, is this about race?
The two things that it mostly is about are about housing and schools. And surprisingly, what you see in terms of race is that most cities that this is a phenomenon in are actually losing people of color as well as whites. It's middle-class people of all races. And it has more to do with the cost of living and issues about schools and the high cost of housing.
Well, and you profile white couples who say, in fact, one of the reasons they're not liking having to make this decision to leave is that one of the things they're going to miss about a city when they leave is diversity.
Exactly, yeah. And a lot of people are really torn because they moved to a city in the first place, and there's a big return to the cities in the late 90s and early 2000s because people really enjoy the mix of culture and the diversity that that a city has to offer. And then they have kids and they find that they can't afford to live there anymore.
You mentioned the two issues that are really behind this exodus, housing and perceived thoughts about schools. What do you mean by the word perceived?
Some of that is actually genuine. I shouldn't say it's just perception about the schools. When traditionally parents could afford to live in the city, they could find a large enough house and were able to afford to send their kids to private school. And now with housing just skyrocketing in many of these cities.
And the invention of the condo.
Right.
You know, suddenly all the housing is, you know, one and two rooms.
Absolutely. And it's just not large enough. That's the biggest addition of housing stock to many of these cities are small condos. And parents are finding that in order to afford a single family home, it's a huge jump from the condo that may have sufficed when they were just a couple or just had one small child.
Well, what about the schools? Because you write that there is this, you know, thinking about the schools when in fact Boston has won an award.
Yeah, and that surprised me because I think as much as anyone living here in Boston, you know, have this negative perception of the schools. The award that they won was actually a most improved award, I should say that.
Yeah.
And, you know, Boston, and as well as many cities, have made a lot of strides in the last decade of really improving their school system, improving test scores and improving a lot of those standards. However, they still, in their comparison to the suburban districts around them, they still lag far behind. And I think Even more, there's just a huge variation between schools. So you may have one school that's very good and then a number of other schools that aren't so good and are lagging behind. And so there's a challenge for parents to try to get into the right public school.
You write from personal perspective. In fact, much of the research is of your close friends.
And some of it is, yeah.
And you also, how many children do you have?
I have two kids now, a two-year-old and a nine-month-old.
And you describe a scene in which after a harried day, you know, you and your wife, young parents, just pretty much explode. Why?
I think it's probably a scene that every parent can relate to. And, you know, it was after a long week of work and going back to work after dinner and realizing that we were just working so much to try to afford the place that we were living, which wasn't big enough. And, you know, we were going to have to find a bigger place or move out in the next couple of years. And then thinking about, you know, schools down the road a couple of years for us, just, you know, the pressures there, I think, are really enormous.
You tell anecdotes of what some of the things that people are doing to get this schooling for their kids, such as...
This really surprised me. Many parents are so dedicated to living in the city that many of them are getting pushed out kicking and screaming. I talked to one woman who sublets out her apartment in the city and then rents a place in a neighboring suburb so she can send her daughter to school there. Another one who still lives in the city technically but spends the weekdays in Newton, which is an affluent suburb outside of Boston, and sends her daughter to school and then comes back on the weekend. The mother and the daughter actually are both going to live with the aunt 5 days out of the week, and then they come back on the weekend. So they're basically living out of their car.
Well, you know, when I was reading that, and while there's sympathy with parents who are trying to get good schools for their kids, I'm looking at it through another point of view, and I'm thinking this kind of an article, you know, might outrage parents who don't have the means, who live
sure.
in the inner city, and they know that when there is this kind of family flight, their schools suffer.
Right, exactly. And I think what you're seeing is it's really the people in the middle who are leaving. It's the middle-class families who have a choice and can send their kids to private school or can leave to go to a suburb that they can afford. What you're seeing in a lot of cities are this bifurcation where you have a lot of affluent families and then a lot of poorer families. And those middle-class neighborhoods that are really kind of the glue that keeps the city together and provides that kind of upward mobility that cities are traditionally famed for, those are the ones that are coming out missing, and there's a lot of statistics that show that.
That's the big problem with what we're talking about, that has that impact of not, as you said, holding the city together.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, the mayor of San Francisco talks about kids as being the soul of the city and the spirit of imagination in a city, and, you know, not to get all Whitney Houston about it and the kids are our future, but, you know, there is a sense that's really the case, that when you do have kids, you start to really think about your city differently, and you start to have concerns about zoning and about, you know, neighborhood development and schools that maybe you didn't have before, and it's really important.
A lot of the parents that you talk to feel that and seem to feel guilty about it because they dreamed of living in the city and having this diversity and being the, you know, middle-class glue that could hold it together.
Yeah, and you see just a lot of hand-wringing among these parents, almost apologizing for moving to the suburbs. You know, which is not to say that everyone feels that way. You know, there's certainly people who don't see this as a problem and see that, you know, this is actually just part of the natural cycle and that, you know, this could actually change the suburbs as well and make them more diverse and more lively and more full of things that the city is traditionally known for.
Right. I'm just thinking of one parent that stood out. She was appalled by one of the inner city schools that her child was attending. And yet she said, I can't save all of those kids who didn't
right.
have enough pencils, who didn't have, you know, any extracurricular activities, but I have to save mine. Reporter Michael Blanding on so-called family flight. When we come back, how Vancouver changed its housing policies to keep young families from leaving and how other cities are following Vancouver's lead. And later in the program, just this quick note, why you shouldn't sit our chef Kathy Gunst next to best-selling author Barbara Kingsolver at your next dinner party. We'll tell you why. Back after the break, here and now. We're talking about family flight, young middle-class families leaving cities in search of bigger, less expensive homes, better schools. Our guest is Michael Blanding, who wrote about this issue for yesterday's Boston Globe magazine. Michael, we've just been hearing about the problems, but now let's talk about what cities are doing to keep young families. You visited San Francisco, where the mayor there, Gavin Newsom, has made it his goal to reverse family flight. Tell us how San Francisco is approaching this.
San Francisco was actually inspired by Vancouver, which in the late 80s decided that they really wanted to revitalize their downtown. And instead of doing it with young professionals, they really decided that in order to foster community, they would do it with families. And so they actually mandated the number of family-friendly housing units. They went to developers and they said, no ifs, ands, or buts, 25% of units need to be family-friendly.
No negotiating.
No, and it went beyond just the affordability or the number of bedrooms to things like the size of closets and the proximity to daycare and family-friendly restaurants. And they presented it as an opportunity to developers, which eventually bore fruit and said, we're opening up this whole new market for you, which is families in the urban core. And eventually there was buy-in from the developers. It took a while.
Well, you said this was a couple decades ago. What was the success?
Yeah, so this started in the late 80s. And since then, they've gone from practically zero children downtown to something like 7,000. So it's really revitalized their downtown. And in the same way that a number of American cities have revitalized their downtown, except Vancouver did it with children and with families and not with young professionals.
Coffee shops.
Exactly.
Right.
And so a number of cities have since picked up on that. And in fact, the former head of planning at Vancouver has actually consulted to a number of cities like Seattle and Portland and Chicago, and has actually helped them to put some of those policies in place.
So how has San Francisco implemented what was started in Vancouver?
So San Francisco, more than any other city, has really taken the lead on taking what Vancouver did for their downtown and applying it to all neighborhoods. And they're in the process of mandating that 20% of housing in each neighborhood in San Francisco has these family-friendly qualities. The mayor there has really made it a signature issue. They've held a number of citywide conferences, you know, specifically on the issue of family flight. They're really tackling both the housing and the school issue together. They've invested heavily in schools, but not just the curriculum, but the kind of things on the edges of the schools that are really important to middle-class parents, like extracurricular activities and art and music and gym.
You cite these as one of the reasons that some parents will leave a city because their child wants to play a certain sport or play a certain instrument.
Many middle-class parents will say, you know, well, the academics I can take care of myself. I know that, you know, I can make sure that my child learns, but I can't do anything about, you know, the fact that the school doesn't have gym or doesn't have the sports they play or doesn't have an art or a music program. And so that can be a deciding factor for many people.
You were you know, talking about things on the edges. Was it in San Francisco that there were programs like sitting little kids down and having them write letters and then walk to the post office to mail the letter? Was that a program there?
It was, and they're doing a lot of really innovative after-school and preschool. They're pushing to have universal preschool and really innovative after-school programs to again, support these kids.
Yeah, and public-private partnerships as well.
Right. A lot of it actually comes from the parents. You have these parents who are going to schools and saying, I don't want to leave the city. I'm going to adopt the school down the block, and I'm going to write a grant, and I'm going to push to, you know, put in a new running track, or I'm going to push to, you know, get an art teacher one day a week. And they're really taking it upon themselves to make their school the model of what they want to be.
Is there a lot of that, parents actually getting together, forming consortiums, and writing grants?
Yeah, I was surprised to find that it's a growing phenomenon, and smart cities are trying to help foster it within city government as well and try to support parents who are doing this. But of course, it creates a number of other issues about, you know, some schools that then become, you know, the sought-after schools that can be difficult to get into, and then other schools and maybe other neighborhoods that aren't, you know, as prestigious. And so it creates that kind of disparity all over again. Some thorny issues there.
What about safety? Now, you know, we've learned all too well that security isn't just an inner city issue, you know. We've seen it at schools across the country.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I found that there was as an aside, I found that this issue does cut across racial lines, but that there were different issues with families of color because they were, you know, in some ways more reluctant to leave the city because of the diversity aspect. One particular family was living in a neighborhood that they just seen deteriorate. You know, even as we hear that crime statistics on the whole have gotten better, you know, there's certainly different neighborhoods and different areas that are getting worse. And this family just decided they'd had enough. The father was actually at the YMCA and somebody burst in and said there had been a shooting down the street. And that was really a wake-up call to him. It really rattled him. And they started looking at houses outside the city.
Well, it seems as if, I mean, that's just, you know, one of the things that would have to be worked on.
Yeah, and I think that that's something that cities are aware of. I mean, crime is certainly something that cities have traditionally worked on. I found that on the whole, it wasn't as big a factor for people I talked to. You know, it wasn't like the 80s or the early 90s where people were really afraid of crime in the city. But there were certainly some people in particular neighborhoods of the city who felt like it really was a deciding factor for them.
So a push to increase family housing, a push to pour money into the schools, at least in San Francisco, to, you know, try to make them equitable with suburban schools, maybe some security issues as well.
Hmm.
Anything else for you? I mean, you're going to have to make this decision. You know,
yeah.
What else would keep you in the city?
Yeah, as I say in the story, you know, it's really something that my wife and I is just on the horizon for us. And in part, I was inspired to write the story because of the conversations that I've been having with my wife and with friends who are in a similar situation. And I'm not going to spoil it for you, but I end the story really undecided. And after everything that I did, after all the schools that I visited, after all the parents I talked to, after the city officials that I talked to, I still feel like it could go either way. And it really depends on what I see happen with the schools, what I see happening with housing prices in the next couple of years. I couldn't tell you what I'm going to do.
And it has to be both, too. You want to point that out, because parents are finding themselves, you might find a school that you love and you're living in one room.
Sure, right.
Or you find the housing and you can't get into a good school. So.
Right, right. You can't afford to, you know, once you have more than one child, you know, private school starts looking pretty prohibitive.
Yeah. Michael Blanding's article, The Departing, about young middle-class families leaving cities in search of better schools and more affordable housing, appeared in yesterday's Boston Globe magazine. You can read it at our website, here-now.org. Michael, thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, almost 6 years after the 9/11 attacks, why has the world's most impressive military failed to catch Osama bin Laden? Also, Peter Fonda on his role in the new old Western 310 to Yuma. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, American workers, did you know that you're some of the most productive in the world? We'll meet a few American workers who work the night shift in New York City. It's after, well, a break in the news. Here and Now. On this Labor Day, a new report from the UN shows that Americans may work harder than people in most other wealthy nations. Americans work longer hours and create more wealth than anyone else, with productivity at nearly $64,000 a year per worker. Americans also get more work done per hour than workers in all other nations except for Norway, even when those workers should by all rights be asleep. Everyone has them. Every town has them. But on this Labor Day, we go to New York City to hear from workers on the graveyard shift in the city that never sleeps.
My name is Ahmad Ibrahim. I've been cabbie since 1983.
Where are you going, sir?
72nd East River, no?
Sure. You know, when you drive a taxi, you have to be a comedian when you have to. You got to be a psychologist when you have to. One girl, she was complaining about having a very hard time, and she just broke up with her friend, and, you know, and we joke around, and I said, listen, don't get sad, you know, just if you keep smiling in my car, it's no big deal. Next nice guy is going to get in my car, I'm going to get his goddamn number for you. And when she paid me, I said, okay, Miss America, stay in touch. She said, by the way, my number is there. She put her number between the dollar bills. So 3 days later, I pick up one guy from down here, and he's a stockbroker. I said, listen, man, I have a very nice gift for you. 2 days later, I call her. She said, okay, give him my number. So like maybe 3-4 weeks later, they call me from downtown. Hey, are you going to come to pick up us? I said, us? Hallelujah. I really love it because this is mission accomplished.
My name is Antonio Polisi, and I'm a supervisor for Rick Narana, and we're doing construction overnight on 5th Avenue and 53rd Street. This is a hole we're digging out for an elevator pit. We're bringing it down 6 feet down. We're chipping into bedrock, which most of New York is on. It's the hardest rock to chip through. 40 hours of this machine. Normally, at any other surface, you'd probably make it to China with it. But because this is so hard, this is as far as we got at 6 feet. I lose bearing the time all the time. We don't see our families. Our pay scale is high. We all get time and a half. When people work straight 40 hours at straight time, and we work out 40 hours at a time and a half, it's almost like $1,000 extra a week. I think I speak for all of us here that we need an extra $1,000 a week. So I explained to my wife, there's more money for you to spend, you know, if I work at nighttime. Every once in a while, we'll get a weekend off, right, Lou? We'll get a weekend off, and we get to spend time with our families.
My name is Anthony Muley. I'm the executive director of a company called Gumbusters of New York and New Jersey. People call us because they have a gum pollution problem. We have a machine that removes gum from virtually any surface, indoors or out. You turn on the machine and the machine heats up. So basically, we're ready to go. And what we do is turn on the steam button and inject the chemical and motion. And it basically dissolves the gum in seconds. In Manhattan, I have to say, on 42nd Street, there's just gum on top of gum on top of gum. The concentration is the most I've ever seen. I do think it's disgusting, but I have to tell you, it's business, so I don't mind so much.
My name is Brendan Corr. I'm the general manager of the Sullivan Street Bakery, and we're finishing up the bake for the night. We're not officially open all night. Official bakery hours for the retail are 7 to 7, but our door is always open and we always have bread. So if somebody knocks on the door, we're going to let them in and sell them bread. You have, you know, night people who are just getting off of work. You have people who are just stumbling out of the bar and need something to chew on. And, you know, people in the neighborhood know that we're here who are just night owls. We'll stop in and get some bread. You have to like working at night. It's usually a quieter working time. There's no hecticness of a day. These guys that come in at night know what they have to do every night. It's hard to get used to it right off the bat. First couple nights falling asleep, standing up while I was working, which is always safe when you're standing in front of a 500-degree oven.
And the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that a flag was still there.
Oh, my name is Andrew Macchio. I've been working with the Department of Sanitation for nearly 23 years. I'm in my 23rd year now. I've always sung behind the truck as I'm working. I have to. It's what gets me through my job. My job isn't glamorous. It keeps my mind off what I'm dealing with, number one. It keeps my mind off my problems. You know, I hope I put a smile on somebody's face as they're walking to the subway, as they're walking to work, take their mind off their problems, get them to sing or even to hum or whistle. And one woman just tapped me on the shoulder. I turned around and all she had to say was, "You put a smile on my face." That makes my day, believe it or not. If I can do this for somebody else, I don't despair in the fact that I'm not helping somebody. I could never pursue a singing career because, believe it or not, I have stage fright.
And have it all, I'll go it alone.
I never liked working in an office. I just didn't like the confinement. I love the physical work of it. It keeps me going. You meet people.
Daring to try to do it or die, I've got to be me.
I like being up, especially when it's the morning and it's still a little dark. And gradually it gets lighter and lighter and lighter. The brighter the sky gets, the quicker I am to being done, because I know it's almost quitting time.
I've got to be free. I've got to be free. Daring to try to do it or die. I've got to be me.
He was good. He should quit his night job. Our profiles of New York City night shift workers came to us from public radio station WFUV in New York. And these notes from the campaign trail. Labor Day traditionally marks the start of the presidential campaign. This year it's been well underway. Senator Hillary Clinton and her husband, former President Bill Clinton, are in Iowa today. Senator Clinton has a new stump speech saying she would bring change and experience to the White House after being criticized by her rivals for being too cozy with Washington elite. Bill Clinton will be doing a major media tour this week with the release of his new book, Giving: How Each of Us Can Change the World. Also on the trail, Democrat Barack Obama in New Hampshire, he got a Hollywood endorsement from George Clooney this past weekend. He called the senator a rock star. On the GOP side, Republicans are waiting for former senator and actor Fred Thompson to officially throw his hat in the ring on Thursday. He has name recognition as the star of Law and Order. NBC has stopped airing episodes featuring Thompson, but the cable network TNT is going in the other direction. They will air 23 episodes this week alone. We all know we're doing something good for the environment when we plug in those eco-friendly compact fluorescent light bulbs. Even retail giant Walmart is on the bandwagon.
See this funny-looking light bulb? I got it at Walmart. If every Walmart shopper, all 180 million of us, would buy one of these, it would be like taking a million cars off the road.
But what happens when compact fluorescents die? You have to dispose of them properly or you've canceled out your environmental gains because these compact fluorescents contain the toxic chemical mercury. We're going to have more about that in a few minutes. But first, a report from Here and Now's Nancy Cook.
It's late afternoon at the Cambridge Drop-Off Recycling Center. Residents are unloading pieces of cardboard, old electronics, books, and clothes. Sylvia Fine considers herself environmentally savvy. She composts and uses compact fluorescent lights in her home.
I'm told that it's the environmentally correct thing to do.
But like many people, Fine's not sure how to throw out these lights.
I understand that they have mercury in them and that they do need to be disposed of in some careful way, but I haven't come to that yet. They're supposed to last 10 years. I figure somebody will have figured something out by then.
But unfortunately, Massachusetts hasn't sorted it out yet. The state doesn't require anyone to collect or recycle these bulbs. A state law passed last summer is forcing the light bulb manufacturers to educate consumers about safe disposal. Environmentalists such as Elizabeth Saunders of Clean Water Action worry that this law doesn't go far enough.
That seems like a lot of work and onus on the consumer. Any manufacturers making a toxic product should have the responsibility for preventing any pollution from that product from, you know, as we say, cradle to grave, making sure that from the initial manufacture of the product all the way through the disposal, it's safe and no toxics are getting out into the environment or into people's bodies.
About 60% of Massachusetts cities and towns voluntarily recycle compact fluorescent lights through their public works departments. So does IKEA and a handful of Cambridge hardware stores. Mike Cohorse of the light industry group National Electrical Manufacturers Association says other businesses could help out.
There may be efficient ways to have drop-off points, but in order to do that, the most logical way to do it is through retailers. And retailers, by and large, are very resistant to that sort of thing. They don't like to serve as the recipient of everybody's waste.
So consumers like Sylvia Fine from Cambridge's Recycling Center are left wondering what to do. Greg Cooper of the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection says the agency is aware of this problem.
At this point, I think we recognize that we are in a place where we need to build a stronger infrastructure, provide more options for residents. We're working on that in conjunction with retailers and the manufacturers. And I would anticipate in the coming months that many more options will become available for consumers to properly dispose of and recycle lamps and compact fluorescent bulbs.
More options will have to surface since the state won't allow any mercury products into the landfills starting in May 2008.
That's Here and Now's Nancy Cook. So how do you dispose of these so-called green bulbs? Well, that's Ray Grasick's business. He's president of Northeast Lamp Recycling in Connecticut. He joins us now. And Ray, what do you do?
We have equipment that's been specially designed to manage the material. Mm-hmm. The lamps are introduced into this machinery, and it's broken apart, and the mercury-containing components of the lamp are cleaned from the glass and metal. That gets put into separate drums. It goes through a process by which the mercury is cooked out of the calcium phosphate powder for reuse again in lamps. So there's a closed loop there.
Ah.
And then the clean glass and metal and plastics are taken and they go off to markets to be reused.
So you don't have to dispose of mercury waste?
No.
Well, what can the average citizen do? Because they certainly can't set this up in their backyard. And if they live across the country, it's probably not wise to send you their bulbs. I mean, what can they do?
Well, there's recycling facilities sited in about 34, 35 states. Typically, a consumer would bring the lamps to a household waste collection day if that's available to them. Or what some communities are doing now is setting up collection points at their town garages for consumers to bring the lamps back there and drop off for recycling also.
So push your town or company to get involved and make sure that the process they get involved in has a closed loop, as you said, on the mercury.
Correct.
Yeah. Ray Grazik, president of Northeast Lamp Recycling in Connecticut. And by the way, you can go to our website, here-now.org, for more information about the kind of recycling he's talking about. Ray, thanks so much.
Well, thank you very much, Robin.
And after a quick break, local food for fall. Back in a minute, here and now. Ah, Labor Day, when our hazy daydreams start to switch from the lake and the ocean to plaid, falling leaves, the harvest, apples, pumpkins, and that wonderful late summer produce, corn, tomatoes, perhaps. Here with more on this season's bounty, here and now resident chef Kathy Gunst. Kathy, welcome as always.
Hello, Robin.
Because everything smells good when you come. We're going to get to what's...
It is rather aromatic in here.
It is, and we'll get to what that is. But, you know, I remember last time you were here, we were actually also grieving the end of the summer, and it was June or something.
Right, we had a cold, wet June. But here we are at the official end of the summer, and it's always a melancholy time of year for me. I think my brain is programmed to the fun is over and school starts. It's hard to let go of that.
But you have a recipe that helps us. Hold on. What have you got?
Well, I've got all kinds of things. My garden is in full bloom. Everybody's garden, the farmer's markets are overflowing. It is the time of year not to do any shopping in a supermarket if you can help it, but the corn is spectacular. One of the things we like to do, of course, you know, we love to just steam it. We love to just eat corn on the cob. A Mexican style way of doing it is to grill it on the grill, and then you take it off when it's just charred, and you coat it in grated Parmesan or crumbled feta and sprinkled chili pepper on it. That's fabulous. But for breakfast, which is something we don't think of with corn, I make corn fritters, and it's a 5-minute process. You beat an egg, a little milk, some flour, fresh corn right off the cob. You just cut it right off, and you make these fritters and serve them with maple syrup for breakfast. It is a 5-minute recipe. All the sweetness of the corn with a little bit of maple syrup, it will make, you know, a late summer, early fall morning something fabulous.
And you do it right in the pan. We'll have, you know, all the directions at our website, here-now.org.
Right. Recipes will be up, but the corn fritters are simple and delicious. I mean, corn, you can't go wrong with it.
Right.
But to cut it off the cob, you know, you take your knife and you just cut right straight down the cob. But then you turn your knife around and use the blunt side and scrape down after the kernels are off, and you'll get the corn milk. Most people miss this. You just push it down with the blunt side of the knife, and this oozy, milky stuff comes off, and you do want to use that in any recipe because that's the essence of the flavor.
Terrific. Okay, I had a taste I want to alert you to. I discovered a new taste this summer.
Taste alert?
Huckleberries.
Mm.
Out west, Idaho, Utah, Montana area. In particular, there's a place right outside Jackson, Wyoming, that serves huckleberry shakes.
Oh, yum. They're like wild blueberries,
they
right?
They are. You know, they're, you know, related to the blueberry, although don't tell people out west that, because to them, they're, you know, crunchier, more delicious, and hard to find. I guess you can't so far cultivate them. Researchers say they hope by 2010 to make a huckleberry you can cultivate, but right now you can only get it wild.
But it won't taste the same. It's
no,
the same thing with blueberries. We've got them here in New England, end of the season blueberries and raspberries are coming in. Cultivated blueberries, they just can't match the tart, very slightly sweetness of a wild blueberry. There's nothing like it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we have some definite sweetness here in the studio. First of all, you've brought a basket of some of the produce from... I don't believe this. These things are huge. This is from your garden?
This is from my garden. This is a joke. This is a zucchini the size of a child's baseball bat.
Yes, it is.
And in southern Maine, where I live, up and down our street, there are signs in people's front yards saying, please take this, and you'll see these gigantic zucchini. You can't get money for these things. People will practically pay you to take one. When they get this big, they're almost useless, but you can grate them and put them into a zucchini pancake. You could do those fritters I talked about with grated zucchini instead of corn. Mm. You can make a zucchini bread, a zucchini cake, but I just thought it would make a nice mascot for the office here. But I don't know if you can smell it. I have a gorgeous bunch of Thai basil and lemon basil. I grew about 4 or 5 different varieties there.
Beautiful.
Yeah, take a whiff of that.
Oh, yeah.
And then these are fabulous. This is called the kaleidoscope carrot. It's kind of a bright yellow. And if you want to take a bite. Very loud crunch.
And it's yellow.
It's called kaleidoscope carrots. They come in purples and regular oranges and all these different shades, and they're just spectacular.
Beautiful.
And I have some Swiss chard, which is wilted from the car ride, but this is called Bright Lights, and I love to chop this and saute it and put it in omelets, put it on top of pasta or rice.
You know what I'm noticing here, Kathy, is that, you know, we go into the produce department of a store. You don't smell the way I'm smelling this basket. It smells like the earth. It's amazingly powerful.
It is the earth. I picked it this morning. It came out of my garden. You know, eating locally is the new organics. It is truly the way to eat. And people are becoming very conscious about carbon footprints and about where their food comes from. Organics was really the buzzword for so many years. But we're now discovering that there's no food like food that's grown near your backyard.
There's a huge controversy over some Whole Foods stores, for instance, growing organic foods, but then flying them thousands of miles.
Exactly. And this is the time of year. This is harvest. So you don't need to look very far. I don't care where you live in this country. There's a farmer's market nearby. Forgetting about the political ramifications and the environmental ramifications, in terms of pure flavor, you can't beat it.
Mm. Well, you remind us, you know, there's been a lot of writing about this recently, a lot of local first movements. Barbara Kingsolver, the novelist, has a very popular book out, Animal Vegetable Miracle, A Year of Food Life. She and her family just living on food from the immediate area. What did you think of that?
It kind of turned me off. Huh. She and her family moved to his family's farm in Appalachia, grew all their own food for a year, wouldn't eat anything other than what they grew or was grown within maybe 60 miles or so. I can't be quoted on that. It was very pedantic. I felt like she was a teacher who was wagging her finger at me, and it seemed very unrealistic. I agree with her message. As I just said, local is important. Supporting farmers is important. But the idea of a family going to that kind of extreme, I felt a little overwhelmed by her self-righteousness. I love her novels, though.
Well, I was just going to say, well, so don't sit Barbara Kingsolver next to Kathy Gonstead, your next dinner party.
Oh, I'd love to sit next to her. We'd have a lot to talk about. And I would love to bring her my basket of food. I didn't quit my job to grow this, but I am passionate about gardening.
That's the point, that most people can't go to any extreme. They're so busy getting through
Robin,
their day.
Most people can't put dinner on the table for their children. We still are living in a country where people are eating fast food and takeout food, and they don't understand that if you have really fresh local foods, you don't need to do much to it. This carrot you just tasted, if you grated that and put some sun-dried cranberries in it and a little oil and vinegar, you'd have a gorgeous carrot slaw. It would take you 5 minutes.
Okay, a couple quick questions for you to close. First of all, if I could just grow one thing, I'm a family that's, you know, trying to eat locally. If I could just do one thing in a pot on the deck, what would you suggest?
I would suggest herbs, because you'll have immediate success and it will improve all your cooking. Okay. I would do a little basil, oregano, chives, anything you like. All it needs is a few hours of sun and you'll have instant success and all your foods will taste fresh.
Let's get to the finale here, because I can't stand this anymore. It's right in front of me.
Smelling pretty good in here.
Yeah, we're bridging summer and fall with Kathy Gunst, and you've done that in this dish. What is this?
This is a very simple dessert. It's called a cobbler or a crumble, and right now we've got local peaches, and we've got these wild blueberries, so I mixed them with just a touch of brown sugar, and then I made a crust with some flour, brown sugar, granola, and cinnamon, and the fruit oozes. You bake it for 45 minutes, and it gets soft and tender and smells amazing, and you get this fabulous crunchy topping. What's the verdict?
Is this all for me?
This is for you, Rob. This is the king size portion.
Do you have to share this with anyone?
If you hurry up and eat before the others get in here, you're all set.
This is delicious. And in certain parts of the country, you can make it with huckleberries.
In the fall, you can make it with apples and pears. You can make it with fresh figs. Wherever you are, whatever your local fruit is, this is a recipe that adapts to it. And this will be on the website as well.
Well, we've been talking about and eating food for Labor Day with Here Now's resident chef, Kathy Gunst. For more on her recipes for corn fritters, the blueberry peach crumble, go to our website, here-now.org. Kathy, as always, thank you for coming in, because it always smells so good when you come.
Thank you, Robin. Happy Labor Day, and may summer live on.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.